You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are yet again listening to the Russian Orthodox Nationalist here at Radio Albion. This is being recorded in the wee hours, Sunday morning, July 19th, 2026. Thank you to all of my donors, both great and small. Sometimes I don't get back to everybody who emails, and I apologize for that. It's my fault, but do not take that personally, please. I'm infamous for that, especially on Patreon. But please, if you're not signed up for Patreon, please do so. The sheer amount of material I have on there on many topics, not just the sort of topics I deal with here, is volumes and volumes. I know Apple controls it now, but it's $5. That's not my price. That's theirs. A month, which is, and I'm certainly, worth that. I appreciate anything you can do for me. And what I do for you is, as many have said, give the college education that you never had or that you should have had. And I found it odd going back through the my old files that I had never dealt directly with Ivan the Terrible here since I've been on Radio Albion. Now, last year I dealt with Ivan the Terrible relative to St. Philip. Of course, he didn't murder him. That's a nonsensical myth. But I have so many essays on him at this point. You know, it should be another book, but I can't start any more books. I'm going to lose it. But the truth of the matter is, Ivan the Fourth, the Terrible, meaning the great or the formidable, was indeed a great and formidable man, and a very holy man. Russia had to be ruled by some central structure, even though law enforcement was extremely difficult over the size of the empire, especially the second half of its existence. But the truth of the empire, let's say over the last three centuries, you have 22 rulers over 370 years. When I first got into this topic, it was a way to situate political philosophy, which was my first field, into a living tradition. In this case, Russian Orthodox tradition in Russia, Serbia, Ukraine. That was my purpose. That was the intellectual structure of all of this. My first book, The Third Rome, was written in anger because the absurdity of the insults and the barbs and the taunts that mainstream historians give to Russians in general and Russian rulers. It got to a point where they were unreadable, and they are unreadable. To say that they're biased or false is to be very, very nice about it. The great Emperor Paul, who is a saint in the true Orthodox Church of Russia, in any typical textbook, both in Russia and abroad, he's a madman, a lunatic. But he was nothing of the kind. He did extraordinary things. He passed a new law on the succession to the throne. He ended the era of palace coups and female rule, restored the state council, reformed the Senate, abolished conscription, cleared the debts of all peasants and tax arrears, made sure that they were exempted from work on Sundays and holidays and holiday seasons, fought corruption and bribery, the so-called golden age of the idle nobles. Paul forced the nobles to pay taxes and to serve in the army, which is what the old Russian nobility was had always done. Of course, the elite hated him for this, and you get the nonsense about him that you read today. The gullibility of Anglo-American historians knows no bounds. They'll believe anything, so long as the left says it. I spent a lot of time on two monarchs in particular, of course, Ivan the Fourth, Ivan the Terrible, and Peter the First. The truth is that the peasantry overwhelmingly considered Peter the Great as Antichrist. Leo Tolstoy, for all of his errors and all his problems, described Peter the Great as a raging drunken beast rotten from syphilis. But the myths about Ivan the Terrible, that he killed his son, which is simply not true, despite the incredible painting from Rapin. Peter's mass murders, which were real, were buried under the idea of being a great reformer, a genius, caring only for Russia's prosperity. These are delusional fantasies. These days, as far as Ivan the Terrible is concerned, the authors that I'm reading, Dmitry Belousov, who, like me, tends to get angry as he's writing. He's on the front lines of this kind of revisionism. And his paper, The Slandered Tsar Ivan the Terrible, is very good, from 2019. Other contemporary revisionists are Vadim Siparov, Igor Yevsin, the recently deceased Vyacheslav Monagin, and of course, Oleg Platonov. I've always based my work to a great extent on some of theirs and many, many others besides. Vladimir Putin is a big fan of Ivan the Terrible, in fact, has commissioned many statues of his. And yet, in Russian culture, Tsar Ivan Vasilyevich, since he was the son of Basil III, he really is known only as a character. The Russian film from 1973, Ivan Vasilyevich Changes Profession, was the name of it, directed by Leonid Gaidai, which really essentially is a comedy. Or the 1991 film, Tsar Ivan the Terrible, directed by Vasilyev, based on the story by Soviet writer Alexei Tolstoy and his The Silver Prince. And the other one is simply called Tsar, the 2009 film directed by Paul Lungin. But they're fictional. They are dark fantasies. You know, at least the Gaidai film is a comedy. I mean, he could hide behind that, but it continues to deepen my understanding, this terrible understanding that I've come to, that in the normie world, everything, and I mean everything, that they believe about the world is simply wrong. They live in a censored and sanitized bubble. I went to go look at the 7th grade historical and cultural standard textbooks, and they're mostly online, not entirely, but each has 4 to 7 sections of beginnings, foreign policy, and then the Opportunity, as far as Ivan the Terrible is concerned. And the nonsense is everywhere. The kids are lied to. What it comes down to is, they say, a difficult childhood caused the future czar to become very cruel. They lie about his defeats in war, which never happened. And the Opportunity which was a wonderful phenomenon, they claim it was this bloody orgy of death. And that despite the fact that the very popular president of Russia knows the truth about Ivan. Now, in the last century or so, well, even more than that, the earliest, a few centuries, Nikolai Karamzin, who died in 1826, who was a Freemason and a very famous historian, unfortunately, the Soviet historian Stepan Veselovsky, who died in the 50s, and the Soviet historian also, Ruslan Skudinov, who died very recently. They're the standard in the so-called big names in Russian scholarship on him at the moment. It all comes from Karamzin. Or I should say, you know, Karamzin was the one who took the propaganda against him and made it into... He was an excellent historian on many things. But the slander against Tsar Ivan is inexcusable. The official court historian, there actually was a court historian, the Romanovs in the 19th century, Nikolai Ustilov, who died in 1870, he said, before the publication of Volume 9 of the History of the Russian State, we recognized Ivan as a great sovereign. We saw in him the conqueror of three kingdoms and an even wiser, more caring legislator. And he's referring, of course, to Karamzin's Volume 9 of the History of the Russian State. And what that's based on is the German interpretation of history and so-called memoir evidence, using the notes of people like Andrei Kerbsky. And I wrote in the Barnes Review about him when I first was hired there, who was a traitor and a defector, and Palitsyn. The evidence of foreigners who were paid to harm Russia. But there is this hypnosis that Karamzin has over Russian historical science, and thank God I'm not subject to that. It hasn't dissipated. Stepan Veselovsky, as I mentioned, who died in 1952, your classic Soviet university professor, Solzhenitsyn makes fun of his type all the time. He never said this openly, but his diary has been published very recently. And here's what he says in it. For years, I've been convinced that the Russians not only are culturally backward, but are an inferior race. Foreigners and Russians of mixed origin are more talented, more cultured, and significantly higher as material than the second back in 1904-1906. I was surprised how and on what such a historical misunderstanding of the Russian Empire rests. My opinion of the people has not changed. The cattle remain cattle. The last branches of the Slavic race turned out to be just as incapable of assimilating European culture and developing as a strong state as the other branches that had previously fallen into slavery. They built the Russian Empire under the command of foreign German instructors. And that kind of mentality, again, not he didn't put it in those harsh terms in his writings, but with this diary, we realize who the mentality of one of the dominant Soviet historians. These are the types that wrote the history of Ivan the Terrible. Veselovsky wrote in bitter terms. Wasn't talking about science or anything like that, but this clear hatred of the Russians. And he remains an authority in Russian history. Ruslan Grigorovich, who was more recent, died in 2009, for the most part was a Soviet historian, very, very popular in the West, published in the U.S., Germany, Italy, Japan, Poland, etc. Spent a lot of time on the so-called Synodicon of the Disgraced, the main argument for the Tsar Ivan's alleged bloodshed. The document was really created by him, on these pitiful little handwritten fragments from the 18th century. And he just filled in the blanks for everything else. It's not history whatsoever. But to say that, even if it was true, even if he was cruel, he was never. But that his bloodthirstiness came from his difficult childhood. His childhood wasn't difficult. His father was the great Basil III. Ivan was the first son of his second wife, Lena Glinskaya. Remnants, actually, of Alina's hair have been preserved in the burial of the Kremlin. They are red-haired, and they're the same color of Genghis's hair. And Ivan IV also was red-headed. Both Genghis Khan and, quotes, Batu Khan were red-haired. At this point, there's no question about it. But 1533, the dying prince, Basil, in the presence of his leading boyars, wrote a will in favor of the three-year-old Ivan, and very quickly died thereafter. Ivan was his eldest son. Now, a three-year-old, four-year-old doesn't rule anything. So you can't say he ruled for 51 years. He ruled roughly for 37 years. Now, Basil's will has not survived. You have people under Soviet rule, a lot of the people I just mentioned, who talk about Alina as a rightful successor. It's really ultimately a feminist fantasy. Basil was over 50 years old. Alina was 25 years younger. He never consulted his wife on matters of state. Never once did the Grand Duke invite his wife to any meetings. He wasn't even allowed to see the dying man until the very last hour of his life. It's a fantasy, but it became popular for a short time. The Grand Duke, of course, handed over control to a group of boyars, a guardian council, a council of seven who would look after Ivan until he was 15. And 15 was the age of majority there, like it is 16 in most states in the U.S. The Pskov chronicler wrote of Basil III, he commanded the Grand Duchy to his great son Ivan, and named him Grand Duke during his lifetime, ordering that for a few of his boyars to look after him until he was 15. So there's substantial evidence for this. A few days later, the boyars, on the orders of Elena Agnenskaya, removed the main contender of the throne, Prince Yuri of Demitov, brother of Basil III. Two of the seven, Mikhail Glinsky and Mikhail Vorontsov, were arrested in 1534. They died in prison. The third, Andrei Staditsky, another brother of Prince Basil, attempted to seize power in Novgorod in 1537. He also died in prison. So once again, there was no powerful ruler named Alina, however. And there was never a regent named Glinskaya. They're simple fantasies. But none of this really affected Ivan. Now, in my previous writings, I did exaggerate, I think, his childhood. And the evidence now seems to be precisely that. Ivan was raised by his uncle, Yuri Glinsky. Ivan turned 15 in 1545, but didn't become ruler at that time. According to the plan of the Glinskys, the Metropolitan Makarios of Moscow, Ivan the Terrible was crowned Tsar. And the coronation came as a complete surprise to many of the oligarchs, some of the boyars that didn't want a strong monarch at all. After the coronation, the Glinskys, Ivan's relatives on his mother's side, strengthened their position, but the oligarchs took revenge. Just 6 months later, they organized a popular uprising after the Great Fire of Moscow in June 1547. The Muscovites put the blame on the Tsar's maternal relatives from the Glinsky family for the fire. The rebellion began, and Yuri Glinsky was stoned to death inside the Cathedral of Dormition in front of the Metropolitan, who was horrified at the idea. Yuri's brother, Mikhail, tried to flee to Lithuania but failed. Anna, the Tsar's grandmother, was accused of using sorcery to start the fire. So this all led to the fall of the Glinsky clan. And ultimately what it did is strengthen the position of Tsar Ivan. Ivan, universally, was extremely well-read, intelligent, active, religious. There's nothing really unusual about all of this, though, and a lot of this intrigue didn't necessarily affect Ivan directly. Many of you have seen the painting from Viktor Venetsov, that like a vampire, the picture of him, this skinny, shabby guy. It's completely fictitious. No portraits of the Tsar, no engravings, no frescoes, nothing show any of these features whatsoever. According to the reports from European ambassadors about his appearance, it was nothing like that. Ivan didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he wasn't known for any kind of love affairs, and he was distinguished by a tremendous work ethic. As I mentioned, we know that Ivan the Terrible was red-haired because in 1963, his tomb was opened. He was a red-haired, broad-shouldered, very well-built man, roughly 5'9" tall. The truth is that Ivan was building a strong Russia. And the eternal enemy of the Russian Empire was not Germany, but the British. And they poisoned him. His court physician was also an astrologer and God knows what else, Eliseus Bomelius, who was connected to British intelligence through the merchant Richard Chancellor, gradually, over time, poisoned the Tsar with mercury. Now, he was a legitimate physician from Oxford, but he was arrested and he confessed. Same thing happened to the Tsarina Anastasia. Ivan believed that she was poisoned, and this was the conclusion of the scientists who examined Anastasia's remains when her tomb was opened in 2000. The spectral analysis of the queen's dark blonde braid, the hair follicle test, in other words, showed tremendously high content of mercury, which was a weapon of poisoners of that era. It seems that the abundance of osteophytes in the bones of the skeleton shows that Ivan was practically paralyzed in the last years of his life. And so this nonsense that he kills his own son in a fit of rage is just physically impossible. Now, what happened to the Tsar's son? He was not hit with a staff, and although that painting of him with his eyes wide open, is the Rapine painting. Most of you probably know what I mean. It's an incredible display of emotion by any painter anywhere. But unfortunately, it's fiction. What happened to the Tsar's son, also named Ivan? He fell ill on a pilgrimage. After about 10 days, he died. And in 1963, the first opening of the tombs in the Archangel Cathedral of the Kremlin, where medical, chemical, and forensic examination of the remains revealed mercury levels 32 times higher than any normal level. Not to mention arsenic and lead, several times higher than a normal person. So he was poisoned. By three things, really. He died by poisoning, not by Ivan the Terrible himself. I think the murder theory was first put forth by the Vatican ambassador, Antonio Posavino, and a few from Britain at the time, like Jerome Horsey. So there's no question about it. I mean, the scientific conclusion is just that. There's the level of fiction concerning Ivan the Terrible. They've created this cartoon character, as they've done with many others, as we well know. from Hitler to Suharto to Putin to General Park and South Korea, depending on, you know, what you're interested in. Those who have been successful in building a strong state are demonized in ways that really are like a cartoon. Now, beginning of the 16th century, Russia was a fairly relatively small state. The borders were from, you know, the region of Great Novgorod, Rezhan, Vyazma, and Chernigov. Population maybe 8 million people. The maximum territory was maybe 1.5 million square miles. A lot of that was empty. Second half of the 16th century, the Crimean raids, slave raids, the Crimeans working both for the Ottomans and the Jews, the Russian population began to leave their homes and moved north, as far as the Urals. So when Ivan took over, his goals were quite simple. Obviously, to stop this, and to stop it, to absorb the remnants of the Golden Horde, the Kazan, Astrakhan, and the Siberian kingdoms, Khanates, and to return Russia beyond the Ural Ridge. And this expansion of territories established trade links in the east, and of course controlling the Volga trade route ensured security. Under Ivan, the state's territory almost doubled. It's larger than the rest of Europe put together. It's Ivan, who inherited only the Moscow and Novgorod regions from his father, transformed them into what we call modern Russia, founded at least 40 more cities. Obviously, cities don't just spring up out of nowhere. Russian cities, unlike many others, say, in the British Empire, Russian cities started off as a military settlement for security. The population would grow, and then a fortress, and then trade would go from there. And this is how settlements became cities over time. To ensure the safety of the waterway from Kazan to Astrakhan, these fortresses, which eventually became cities, were built on the Volga. And these were cities we hear about all the time. Samara, Tsaritsyn, Saratov, Yeletz, Belgorod. One of the greatest architectural structures of pre-Petrine Russia was built as Smolensk Fortress, especially the wall. It was a boom in cities, a boom in trade, continued to the end of the 16th century. All of this was the work of the patriot Ivan the Fourth, Ivan the Terrible. Let's be clear about something else. Ivan never lost a war. There were defeats in some individual battles, of course, but unsuccessful campaigns, unsuccessful wars didn't happen. Let me give more detail to that. Ivan had his hands full, as did so many rulers like him, as I mentioned already. There were three directions to ensure the security of Russia: expansion to the east, the south, and to the west. The east, the annexation of Kazan, 1556, Astrakhan, the next year, Bashkiria, and of course, the bringing of Siberia under Russia through Yermak's campaigns. He saw himself as the heir to the empire of Genghis. Not Mongols in the Asian sense, there was no such concept. They didn't rule Russia. But the territories of what the Golden Horde was. Three campaigns to capture the Kazan Conant to stop, at a minimum, the constant raids to seize Russian slaves. It didn't take long for the Kazan Khanate to lose the right bank of the Volga in 1546. But, you know, the big problem that Russian units had was supply problems in the roads. There was a bombardment with cannon, of course, the most advanced of the day. They wanted to establish the fortress we call Sivyask, just 20 miles from Kazan. A base to attack the Khanate's capital. Now, the libel, slander is that because that ended in failure, the Tsar wanted to slaughter everybody. And that simply, of course, is not true. But the third campaign, three columns, huge number of men, actually. Russians had 90,000 men, 150,000 including allies, 30,000 cavalry, and 150 heavy siege weapon, and light cannon as well. Erkamian Khan attempted to lay siege to Tula and failed. The Russian regiments overtook the Crimean army at the Svoron River and inflicted a heavy defeat. The Russian army arrived at Sviyask, and that's when the siege of Kazan began. The city was finally captured. The commanding general was Prince Yuri Pronsky. Astrakhan, on the other hand, was captured really without a fight. The Khan was named Yamgurchi, he fled to Azov. The Nogai horde, which was next door, convinced the Russians to install Dervish Ali as Khan, acknowledging Ivan, the vassal of Ivan IV, and going to pay tribute to everything. And of course, he was betrayed. And this happened quite a bit with Ivan. So there was another campaign that had to be launched in 1556. The Cossacks were a big part of it. The Khan's army was defeated in the Volga floodplains, roughly near Astrakhan. But the city itself was recaptured without a fight. We call that the hostile crescent of Khanate that simply couldn't be allowed to exist if Russia were to survive. Crimea, Astrakhan, Nogai, all dependencies of the Ottoman Empire. Russian capture, these places blocked the old Ottoman route used by merchants and pilgrims between Bukhara and the Caucasus. It was a massive, massive victory. Now, the southern direction was different. That was directed at Crimea directly. And that was really more defensive than anything else. The southern borders of Russia were notoriously porous. He ordered the construction of what's called, depending on who you read, you know, the Russian translation, the Sovereign Line, a lengthy system of defensive fortifications. Not just felled trees or ramparts or palisades, a very intelligent system, ditches and pitfalls, etc., were erected. And the line itself alternated with natural barriers as well as actual fortresses. Troops were usually recruited from nearby villages. Russia had the most advanced firearms, despite the mythology. The system reached a depth maybe of 30 miles and stretched for 800 miles in total, from the Mechersky to the Bryansk Forest. You know, the Tsar Ivan was 25 years old. And the superior army of the Crimean Khan, Devlet I Godey, failed to break the defense of a small Russian detachment entrenched in that very system. After three unsuccessful attacks with heavy losses, the Khan was forced to retreat back to Crimea. the Tsar personally oversaw the reconstruction and readiness of the line and the cities that were founded within it, Kozelsk, Belev, and Volkhov. He built his own Kremlin in Astrakhan. So he would, on a hill above the Volga, so the cannons would guard the entrance to the Caspian Sea. The Ottoman state did try to recapture it, 1563, and it failed miserably. And the new Ottoman Sultan, Selim II, who died in 1574, entrusted the command of this campaign to a Kakassian Pasha, Kaffa, Kassian Bey. He used 15,000 Janissaries, joined forces with 50,000, the Crimean Khan, and thousands of irregulars. 220 ships carrying equipment and provisions were sent by sea to Azov. All told, the Ottoman Tartar forces numbered around 80,000. September 1569, the Ottomans besieged the Astrakhan Kremlin. But a bold attack, or a counterattack, I should say, by the Astrakhan garrison, as well as the attack by the Zaporozhian Cossack cavalry of Ottoman Mikhail Zhivensky, allowed the Russians to seize and turn their own artillery against them. And they took humongous losses. At that point, a reinforcement of 15,000 under Vasily Serebrani finally forced the Ottomans out. They set fire to their own fortifications, they lifted the siege and retreated to Azov. Of the 3,000 Janissaries, 700 returned. Now, I said this before, and it's happened more than once, where the Turks and their allies have lost so many men that even Istanbul itself started to be fortified. They worried about their whole empire, or at least the capital, falling. They saw Ivan as invincible and unstoppable. Once the Opichino was founded, it never was very large. It was a few thousand at most. But in this particular case, Devlet Gudey, as I mentioned before, they outflanked the Russian army stationed on the northern bank of the Oka River. The Crimeans had maybe 100 miles left to travel from crossing to Moscow, and the Khan held the initiative. The Russian received information about the Crimean army's movements, with a delay of about a day. And unfortunately, not the regular army, but the noble muster didn't obey orders. They squabbled over command. And now you had Crimean irregulars approaching Moscow in May of 1571. They were stopped, obviously. But it was because the Crimean army setting fire to their wooden settlement on a very windy day, the flames quickly spread to the outskirts of the city. Moscow, to a great extent, was a wooden city. It was ablaze. This is where the Moscow fire came from. The Khan's warriors were the first to flee the city. Russians eventually captured 60,000 men, and killed another 10,000. Now, the Crimean ambassador to Warsaw said that, or in Warsaw, boasted 60,000 men were killed and 150,000 captured during the campaign. The English diplomat, Giles Fletcher, said that 800,000 Russians were killed. This is a typical, you know, propaganda. The burning of Moscow was not any fault of the Russians, but did not result in any defeat of the Russian troops. But the Ottomans had convinced the Khan to capture and subjugate all of Russia in 1572. And somehow the sight of Moscow burning put ideas in his head. And it goes to show that taking the capital doesn't mean a whole lot in Russia. The Russians were waiting for them. Fortifications along the Oka were repaired. And they were able to put together the Crimean Ottoman army of roughly 120,000 invaded Russia in July of 1572. This was the famous Battle of Molodi, probably the most important of medieval Russia. If it was lost, there would be no Russia. It was a war that was waged for the entire Russian nation. And despite being outnumbered at least 2-1, the Crimean Turkish army was completely destroyed, utterly routed. Even their elite forces were destroyed in 1572, just south of Moscow. And that ended the Crimean-Ottoman expansion into Russia. All of this was done under the command of Ivan at a fairly young age. He never had a boring day as a monarch. This was the stress that he was under. He had no choice but to do this. Battles were lost, no question, but no wars were. Making matters more complicated, there was a western direction, returning ancient Russian land seized by Lithuania and Poland. There was no need to have direct ties with western countries. That wasn't the case. The real reason for this was that the Livonian Order and the Commonwealth wanted to control and limit Moscow's trade, even blockading it once in a while. Now, Muscovy already had access to the Baltic Sea. Southern coast of the Gulf of Finland is Russian land. Now, they claim that the war lasted 25 years, supposedly 1558, 1583. But the fighting didn't last for 25 continuous years. There were isolated battles. There was no such thing as a Livonian War. It was an occasional battle, not a continuous war. But these battles ended with the complete defeat of the Livonian Order, Poland and Sweden, and peace treaties, all of them, were essentially in terms of peace in exchange for the return of all previously captured territories. And by the way, part of this was done while the traitor Kerbsky went to the other side. Let me be more specific. The propaganda against Russia didn't start in 2014, didn't start in Crimea. The war began in the 16th century against Ivan IV. Two lies were spread at the time. First, the beginning of the Livonian, so-called Livonian Wars, the commander of the Russian army was Prince Andrei Kerbsky. He was simply bought by the West. He transmitted information about Russian troops, and then he fled over the border to the city of Vyazma. He gave a lot of information. The Russian army was defeated in the Battle of January 25th, 1564, near Ula. He arrived at the border a very wealthy man. Kerbsky fled, abandoning his wife and his son. He betrayed everything to his new Polish-Lithuanian masters. He gave a lot of information away. King Sigismund II rewarded Kerbsky with rich estates, and today, Western historians consider Kerensky a defender of Russian liberty. He's the one who, one of the major actors in the assaults on Ivan the Terrible, that he was this evil man. These have been collected into books. Four letters to Ivan the Terrible from 1564 to 1579. And another is a very long title, History of the Great Prince of Moscow and the Deeds We Have Heard from Trustworthy Authors and Which We Have Seen With Our Own Eyes, 1581-1583. Kerensky, who had every reason to make up stories about Ivan, who abandoned everything, his people, his wife, his child, orthodoxy, he was the foundation of the information that the West had about Russia at the time. And his work is still taken seriously. Now, in 1971, the American Edward Keenan published something called the Kerensky-Grozny Apocrypha, the 17th century genesis of the correspondence attributed to Prince Kerensky and Tsar Ivan IV. Now, Keenan demonstrated that in the 17th century, Prince Simon Tsiolkovsky, when he went into exile, another commander, took various excerpts from works from all over the place, from 1623, 1625, and stitched them together into a new work. It was a forgery. The Tsar actually allowed Tsiolkovsky to return once he repented, and fearing that the forgery would compromise him, he disguised his work as a message from Prince Kerensky to Tsar Ivan the Terrible, allegedly written in 1564. According to Keenan, all three works were created in the 17th century. Kerensky and Ivan were not the authors of these things. The entire correspondence is a falsification. Now, Kerensky's letters exist in many editions. There are many editions, many lengths. But even a cursory comparison of these, the manuscripts, show that there's tampering with the texts. Yeah, there's certainly, the first slanderous letter existed from Kerensky, no doubt. Ivan's replies did not exist, however. And after that came the falsifications, much later, the 18th century. I mean, Kerensky's lies are still being published in huge print runs in Russia and elsewhere. During the so-called Livonian Wars, 1561, you know, the printing press was developed. The Western, it was called the Flying Leaflet, was printed in Nuremberg. So it was a propaganda poster about the savagery and the ferocity of the Muscovites. And it says they're very vile, terrible, hitherto unheard of. True, new news of the atrocities committed by the Muscovites against captive Christians from Livonia, men and women, virgins, and children. That might be one of the first actual pieces of propaganda against Russia of all time. They had all kinds of false artistic illustrations. The first printing arrived for the troops of the Polish king, Stephen Batory. And I guess many of them believed it. So then the Poles became the source of constant lies about Russia, created the dark myths about Russia and Ivan that spread throughout all of Europe. Now, what is the Synodicon I mentioned? The Synodicon of the so-called disgraced, or the Synodicon of the exiles. It's another slander, the second slander against Ivan the Terrible. Around 1583, Ivan donated very large sums to several monasteries, commemorating the souls of the dead. Ivan the Terrible always was a strict Orthodox man. This is the so-called the Pomyanik, the memorial list. Very common practice. The monasteries were sent lists of people, who historians immediately assume to be Ivan's confession. This is what Karamzin said. This is primary evidence. This is the evidence for the counting of the dead, so-called victims of the Opritina. That very same document compiled by Ruslan Skorinnikov, published in his book, simply named Ivan the Terrible, says there were 3,300 people on that list. Now, of course, as always, the original document has never been seen and has not survived. It's a simple pumyanik. In Russia today, millions of people write these things for their deceased relatives. It doesn't mean they killed them all. It's simply a matter of commemoration. The great writer, Vyacheslav Manyagin, and I mentioned him already in his book, The Truth About the Terrible Tsar, was the first to make this argument. The Tsar simply included people dear to his heart on the list, people whose repentance he wanted to ask God for at the end of his life. This wasn't about people who he killed. So, in any memorial, I guess the translation was memorial note. They're just names. The so-called Synodicon of the Disgrace was compiled by Ruslan Skorinnikov, based on some handwritten fragments, as I mentioned, from the 18th century. It was fabricated. And Yagin has another book called Kursky versus Ivan the Terrible, or 450 Years of Slander. Now, one that might be better known is the slaughter at Novgorod. This is usually the foundation for the hysteria of Ivan as a maniac and a murderer. They use the word pogrom all the time. In December 1569, the new year, 1570, suspecting, and rightly suspecting, the Novgorod boyars of defecting to the Lithuanian, Polish-Lithuanian King Sigismund, to head them off before they did this, Ivan, with his opportunity, set out a campaign against them. He had 15,000 men. Not all of them were his select opportunity, of course. And they claim, though, that he carried out massacres in Tver and Klin and Pskov and Novgorod itself, burning churches, killing people. From the authors I mentioned above, I have four quotes here, what I've called atrocity porn in the past. Here's four quotes. The Punisher spared no one. They tortured and beat adults and children. Ivan ordered Novgorodians to be doused with incendiary mixtures and fried in hot flour. Thousands of people were tortured and perished under the ice of the Volkhov River with sticks and drowned. Almost the entire population of Novgorod was exterminated down to the babies. As usual, no document from this era survives. There's something called the Tale of the Sack of Novgorod by Ivan the Terrible. But the original chronicle simply doesn't exist. It's missing. And the text was edited beyond recognition in the accursed 18th century. But the fact of the matter is, the Novgorod elite really did negotiate with the Polish king. They were surrendering land and converting and everything else for the sake of huge estates. They were giving all kinds of information about aspects of the Russian military over to the Poles. There were some battles lost because of this. The fall of the Izborsk Fortress, for example. Keep in mind that the total manpower of the Opritina never exceeded 5,000 men. The Tsar's Guard, maybe 500. So any claim to 15,000, 20,000, 50,000 is nonsense. It never existed. You know what Novgorod's population was at the time? 26,000. The English diplomat Jerome Horsley counted 700,000 dead. Polish historian Kazimierz Wieslewski said 70,000. The so-called Pskov Chronicle says 60,000. People like Johann Kruse and Johann Taub and Kruse and Prince Kurbsky. So many others. The number keeps going down as time goes on. Here's another quote. The Oprichniki rowed along the river in boats and finished off those who emerged with boat hooks and axes. That's from the Chronicles of the Age of Revolt by Volentsov and Kovalenko. Well, that can't be true. You know why? Because the winter of 1570 was extremely harsh. The river froze to the very bottom. They simply made things up. And there's something else. Much of this was copied directly, and I mean directly, from the story about the chronicle of the sacking of Liège in France by the Burgundians of King Charles the Bold in 1468. I mean a one-to-one copy-paste. Therefore, I think it's very logical to say that in the 1570s, there was no conception of any Novgorod pogrom. There was no massacre. Now, there were arrests. The two chronicles, called Gori and Piskotov. The Oprichniks arrested both foreigners and Russians who incited the separation of lands, of course, and traitorous actions. A traitorous Oprichnik, the German Heinrich von Staden, he wrote, all captured foreigners were executed. The majority of them were Poles, with wives and children, and the Russians who married in the foreign land. Well, the truth is, about 300 were arrested. Each was brought to trial with a very specific set of charges. There was an investigation. Of these, 184 were acquitted. There was no wrath of the sovereign. It was actually an act of justice. It was an act of reason. An actual investigation. This was the best of the Russian legal system. Real crimes of specific individuals were revealed or not revealed. Now, I know I've mentioned this before, but there's the issue that keeps coming up, and idiots will repeat it over and over and over and over again, of Metropolitan Philip II. I did a lecture on him, I think, maybe this time last year. An old friend of Ivan the Terrible. A man who was quite holy and was appointed, despite the fact that many of the powerful hierarchs were against him. Philip was appointed during a dispute between Archbishop Pimen of Novgorod and Archbishop Herman of Kazan. Archbishop Herman already made himself a metropolitan at that point. Philip was a long-time ally of Tsar Ivan IV, and always was, and is known for his sermons condemning the conspirators against him. He never denounced the Tsar's atrocities, never once. There's not a single mention in any real historical document saying so. Now, as I mentioned a year ago, there were invented stories. But when they went back a long way, the two of them. It's really hard to convince either one of them that this one said, you're awful and you know. But the Tsar realized that Pimen did hate Philip. Now the story is in 1569, the Tsar's chief of guards, Miluta Skuratov, personally strangled Metropolitan Philip of Moscow at the Tver Monastery for allegedly refusing to bless the campaign against Novgorod. That's simply untrue. Many documents show the actual murderer. It was a bailiff, Stephen Koblin, a member of Archbishop Pimen's conspiracy. Koblin, I should say, not Koblin. Koblin killed the Metropolitan with the full agreement of the Abbot Philotheos. The politics of Russian hierarchy of the day were vicious, and this is why the state had to step in. That's why Philip was selected in the first place. As a correspondence, sort of a compromise candidate. But there was tremendous jealousy about him. There had always been talk about that Archbishop Pimen was going to kill Philip. Maluta Skuratov did gallop over to Tver to rescue the Tsar's protege, but he didn't make it. He did arrest the actual murderers, though. And guess what? Ivan didn't even execute them. They were simply exiled. Why was he so soft? He was soft. He let traitors back in over and over again, as I've already mentioned. And in the discussion I'm having with, many of you know about it already, with on Ivan Ilyin's on Confronting Evil by Force, on Pete's show, just today, in fact, we discussed the concept of fighting evil itself can turn you evil. He didn't want that to happen. Even in a just war, for a just cause, a good man and taking part of it, because he's killing people, might not end up being the same man that comes back that left. This is why he was as soft as he was. I was told the other day, I'm told this like once a year, that Peter the Great founded the Russian Navy. There would be no Navy without him. Nonsense. Under Grand Duke Ivan III, Russian ships reached England. Russia had many naval operations as early as 1496. A squadron of Pomor ships under the command of Ivan and Peter Ushkakov entered the White Sea, rounded the Kola Peninsula, and attacked and captured three Swedish ships, and landed Marines in Lapland. Inhabitants swearing allegiance to the Tsar. They had a Marine Corps as early as 1496. Having Ivan the Terrible ordered the building of 200 longships, sailing down the Russian part of the Dnieper and entering the Black Sea. They weren't primitive. They weren't like the Drakars of the Viking. This is how the Genoese prefect of Kaffa, Dortelli, this is how he describes them. They are oblong, similar to our frigates. They hold 50 men, are propelled by oars or sails. The Black Sea has always been angry, but now it's even blacker and more terrible in connection with the Muscovites. The Navy, throughout these wars, withstood clashes with the Ottoman Empire's fleet and was normally victorious. Russian Marines landed in western Crimea. The Marines devastated coastal forts of Crimea with impunity for almost a month, freeing thousands of Christian captives from Jewish traitors. Russo-Turkish War of 1672-1681, the Russian Navy performed extraordinarily. I know I'm running out of time here. But the Russian Navy and Marine Corps were such, this is one of the reasons why, as the Crimeans, etc., were being defeated, that Istanbul started to fortify itself. Because the French envoy, the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed IV, wrote, "His Majesty, several Muscovite ships that have appeared near Istanbul are causing more great greater fear than the plague. Russians built their ships for centuries, including icebreakers. John Jane, a British 19th century British historian, had the Russian Navy, considered a comparatively late institution founded by Peter the Great, has in fact a better claim to antiquity than the British Navy. A century before Alfred the Great, who reigned from 870 to 901, built British ships, Russian vessels, fought in naval battles. The foremost sailors of their time were the Russians. Now, I know I had to rush through things in this talk. I'm coming to the end here. I, as always, cram a huge amount of material into a short, you know, there's no fluff here. There's no... On other lectures, I've spoken of other things, other issues, which I skipped a lot. His alleged numerous wives that didn't exist, the lost library, Yopichina, which of course was a wonderful institution, which I've dealt with elsewhere. But this is the beginning of the attack on Russia. You can't say Ivan the Terrible or even Rasputin without having this awful image, which automatically enters, even I have this awful image enters into my brain. My reason has to stop it. That's what happens. You know, to any historian who wants to tell the truth, it's a short circuit. That's what propaganda does. Ivan the Terrible did execute people, very few of them. He was treated the way he was by historians because he was at war with the oligarchs. That's simple. He was venerated as a saint by the common population. Goblinsky of the Moscow Theological Academy fully agrees with this. Icons of him with a halo, they've survived all over the place. It was Ivan the Terrible who legally equalized common peasants with noble princes, introduced universal suffrage in local legislative and executive bodies, guaranteed representation for all segments of the population in the Zemsky Sobor, universal primary education in Russia, and banned private underground prisons that the nobles were controlling. Under Ivan the Terrible, the interests of the government and the nation were not separated. They were one entity. It was actual, true justice. And that's the truth. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.